Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour with me, Carolyn Yeager. It is Monday, March 16th, and I'm doing something a little different tonight. I'm coming to you on a pre-recorded show that I produced myself yesterday. Recall that I said last week that I might not have a program tonight, but I figured out how to record an MP3 by myself faster than I thought I would. So here I am bringing you a program after all tonight, but I'm not live. Tonight's program will also be about 1 hour instead of two. And I also wanted to do this program tonight because I wanted to thank a couple of people for donations that I received a couple weeks ago, which I didn't know that I had received, and so I didn't respond to the people. I didn't acknowledge their donation until yesterday, or the night before yesterday. So I was really shamefaced about that, but the reason was that they came in PayPal, and PayPal always sends me a notification in my email when I get a donation, and I hadn't gotten anything for quite a while. Well, I had a little bit before this, but I hadn't received these, and so I don't go and look at it in this particular account all the time, so I didn't know they were there. And when I did go into this account the night, a couple nights ago, wow, I was so surprised at what I saw. And when I took it all in, then I quickly sent emails to these two people. I was really happy about this one from Pete from Finland, who sent a very generous amount of money to me. And I don't know who he is, if he might be one of those Finnish friends who send comments sometimes. I don't, and use, you know, using not the same name. But anyway, I was very pleased about that, and I wrote to him. And then I got this very special contribution from a person in California, and I'm not sure if I should give his name because I can't remember if he told me not to mention his name or not. I kind of vaguely think that, so I'm not going to say his name. But he is an Italian with an Italian name in California, and he's the one who sent me that contribution about a year ago, or maybe a little longer, that really, really knocked me for a loop. I'll tell you, it was so wonderful. And we exchanged some emails after that, and then we hadn't heard from him for a while. But you know, he sent me, I'm going to give the amount of it because it has meaning. He sent me $500, which is, you know, I don't generally receive anything like that from contributors. And so I was quite, you know, my eyes were bugging open again. And I didn't realize until that night, after I had even written to him, that why it was $500, and that it came on March 1st. It came into my PayPal account on March 1st. And he's not a braggy kind of person, so he doesn't say anything about it. He just sends the money. I realized that was the 5th anniversary of the Heretics Hour, and he follows my shows, and he knew that, and so that's why he sent $500 on that date as like $100 for each year that I've been doing the Heretics Hour. And March 1st was the actual anniversary date for the Heretics Hour. So that is so touching to me. I just thought that was so wonderful and special, and I felt so bad that I didn't even know about it and didn't even say anything to him until March 15th. So this is really not an apology, but I just wanted to mention it tonight. So I didn't want to wait another week to mention it, so I thought I'd better get this show out. And I wanted to test out my recording apparatus here, how I'm doing this. So I also want to thank Kevin McDonald, not for money, but for sending a comment to CarolynYeager.net. He wrote a comment, which most people are not going to see because it's at the last final installment of the Poldy Wenger Letters Home. The Wenger Family Archive on CarolynYeager.net has two sections to it and a lot of material on there by Willie and Poldy Wenger. And Poldy was the one who became a fighter pilot and had an interesting life and wrote about it, either in his diary or in his letters home once he got into the Luftwaffe. And he was at the Annapolis school, too. And I got all that from his dear brother, Willie, who is still living and is a wonderful, wonderful friend. I just love Willie Wenger and his wife, Wilma, who I keep up with, but not as well as I'd like. Well, I just think that's a very special archive there. Made me so pleased to learn that Kevin McDonald read it. And he left a comment at the last installment, and it was very interesting, personal, and intimate viewpoint of one person's war. From the fun optimism in France to the increasingly harrowing and costly reports from the Ostfront, the letters provide a great insight into life on a Schlachtgeschwader. That's a squadron. Thank you so much for publishing these letters home. Regards, Kevin McDonald. I must say, I'm a big fan of Kevin McDonald, and not so much a fan, but I have so much respect for him. And I was quite pleasantly taken aback when I got this letter and realized it was actually from him, and not a letter, but this comment. That also makes me so pleased that he looks at my site and that he read this section and found it very interesting. Of course, it is very interesting. And I agree with everything he says here that, I would thank myself, too, for publishing these letters if I came upon them somewhere. So I encourage people to read them. Take a look at this section if you haven't done so already. And so now my program for tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is about a friendly email that I got from a listener who actually likes Adolf Hitler, but has some thoughts in that are so common amongst people on the internet who think that it's wrong to just see Hitler in just a positive light. There must be some things that he did wrong and some things that we should criticize more, and we should be far more critical of him. Well, he has a lot of criticisms, but I don't know if that's the word that is the best word for them, but I'll say issues. And so he's addressed some issues that he has, and he asked me to do a program on these sometime. So I'm doing it right away because I just got this past week, and I wrote to him and I explained, I answered some of his questions that he wrote back, and again saying very nice and thanking me for being so prompt, but it didn't seem like he was too convinced by what I said. So now I'm going to therefore read his letter to you, his email to you. And then I'm going to go through and give some comments of my own on this. And I hope that will satisfy Jim, the writer, and should be interesting to other people, but I don't know that it's going to change anybody's mind, because these are the kind of things that are constantly brought up and answered, but people who feel that these questions are legitimate in these, not attitudes, but these beliefs about Hitler and National Socialism are valid, are not ready to change their mind about it. A lot of people, like I said earlier, I think that a big part of it is that they don't want to be 100% or 90% or too positive toward Adolf Hitler. They like Germany. And some of them, like him, says he likes National Socialism and even is a National Socialist. But, well, okay, I'm going to read this and you're going to see what he says. So this is dated Tuesday, March 10th, so it's only 6 days ago. And I think that he is referring to a Hitler Table Talk program that he had probably just listened to. And he says, thanks for another great episode. I've been a listener and fan of yours since your days at Voice of Reason. And your show and a few other shows I like are a breath of fresh air compared to the dreadful, god-awful, degenerate Western mass media environment in which we're constantly immersed. Anyway, on the topic of Hitler's beliefs in survival of the fittest, that nature is a ruthless dictatorship, etc., I've often wondered this. The fact remains that Hitler and his party lost World War II, so by their own philosophy, weren't they inferior and unfit to survive in this world? I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but couldn't one argue that Hitler and the National Socialists were ill-adapted to survive this world's environment because they failed to account for the reality of Jews in high places in all the Allied governments? And because a personality cult, which is what National Socialism became, is vulnerable to failure after all, quote, Der Führer is never wrong, unquote, so Hitler's inner circle didn't dare question his tactical errors? He's putting these as questions. I'm specifically thinking of letting the UK Army, the United Kingdom, or British Army escape Dunkirk, the launching of Operation Barbarossa, and the declaration of war against America, in parentheses, to honor the Tripartite Pact, period. He didn't put a question mark there. Had his general said, Mein Führer, are you sure this is wise? And had he listened, I think the disaster that happened and that we live with today wouldn't have occurred. It's for this reason I consider myself a National Socialist as opposed to a Hitlerist, similar to how Marxists will say they're communists, but not Stalinists. I think National Socialism should be about the folk, and not about any one individual, and to put principle before personalities, as the 12 steppers say. My short take on Hitler is that he made some great mistakes, but he was a great man. I'd love to hear you address some of my questions and issues I've raised on a show sometime. Take care, Jim. Well, as I said, I wrote to Jim and gave a few little responses, and he wrote back and thanked me for being brief, but didn't sound like he was convinced by what I said. He's probably pretty well thinks he's got the right attitude here. So anyway, I'm going to go through this now and start here by saying that on the topic of Hitler's beliefs in survival of the fittest, that nature is a ruthless dictatorship, and so on. And I've often wondered that the fact remains that Hitler and his party lost World War II, so by their own philosophy, weren't they inferior and unfit to survive in this world? That was the first thing he said. So that's the first thing I'm answering. And I say, well, the Germans are still on top in this world, but they play ball with the Jews and Jew finance. Hitler and National Socialism were targeted by the Jews for destruction. So I'd like you to see how well you or anybody else would do if you were in that place. I would like to point out that the whole point is the fact that the Third Reich was targeted by the international Jewry and in the other major countries in Europe, United Kingdom, and the British Empire, so to speak, all became the enemies in that battle right at the beginning. But the Jews were behind it, and Jewish finance. When that happens, you've got a lot of enemies. What he is saying is that they fail to account for the reality of Jews in high places in all the Allied governments. He's saying that they should never have gone up against this, you know, because they didn't fail to account for it. They pointed it out all the time. They are very aware of it. But what Jim is thinking or saying, I don't know what he thinks, but he's saying that we cannot go up against Jewish control. And if we do, we should know we're going to get destroyed. So therefore, any attempt to fight for our freedom from Jewish control is doomed. And he goes so far as to say that we're inferior, that maybe the National Socialist philosophy was inferior because they tried to free themselves from Jewish control. If you don't fight it off, you're already destroyed. A lot of people imagine that if Hitler had just stopped, let's say, in 1938, and had left off Poland, not attacked Poland, that somehow everything would have gone on the way it was then, and everyone would have accepted that, and the Third Reich would have flourished. But see, this is a false conclusion to come to, because there are ever so many reasons to understand that that was not going to happen that way. Let me go down to a story I just saw today about fringe parties surging in Europe. And this is a kind of a dumb thing from a Christian Science Monitor trying to give some background on why Europeans are disaffected and why they're turning to these fringe parties that are called soft right parties or soft left parties. And in any case, they gave a couple of examples of Germans. And these Germans said some interesting things, which I think make a good point for what I'm talking about here. He said that this one, I'm just starting somewhere in the middle of the article, at 11 a.m. on a frigid Sunday, Andreas Bost has just finished a five-hour shift as an office cleaner in Dresden, Germany. It's his job to buff the floors at a mall in the heart of this Baroque city. Mr. Bost is happy to be employed, but he is far from content in life. Yes, he knows that Germany is the powerhouse of Europe. Yes, he knows that Germany builds some of the world's best cars and exports some of the finest machine tools, but he doesn't want to hear any of that. What matters to him is that he hasn't bought a new winter coat in 8 years. Germany is not a country, says the minimum wage earner bitterly. It's a company, and we are not the people, we are the personnel. That's interesting, because it makes me think of what Hannah Reich said long after the war, when she complained that Germany had become a land of car makers and something else like that, instead of the great idealistic thinking that went on under Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. And she didn't like it. And this is saying the same type of thing, that Germany has come under, actually, it's come under Jewish finance. It's no longer fighting against it. It's quite content to, it's not content maybe, but the government that's been installed there after its defeat, everything about National Socialism was utterly wiped out. Then what we have is a country that's like the rest of Europe that's going along with the economic idea and the money idea. And this is what Germany is now. And this man is saying that the people who are at the top are doing fine, or even maybe some people in the middle, but he's not doing fine. It's not a country that cares about all of its people anymore. And that's what Hitler did. He cared about all of the people and wanted to make sure that all of the people had a good life and everybody was treated fairly and nobody was taking advantage of the other. But that's no longer there. And what we have now is what we have now in Germany is what you see when Jewish finance and Jewish economics are in control. Now there's another woman, and she's also in East Germany, not in Dresden, but probably not too far from there. And she says, news article says the EU is another favorite pincushion for disaffected voters across Europe. Etta Schaefer, a stylish young grandmother who owns a carpentry business with her husband and son in a little town in eastern Germany, says that she has joined Germany's anti-EU party, Alternative for Germany, because she thinks the euro was an experiment that has failed. Europe is not for the people, it is for big business, she says. Even in Germany, she adds, the statistics look good, but the people are exploited. So she is echoing, in a different way, what the man said. those are good examples of what happens when you are not fighting off the Jewish power and the Jewish control of your country. I hope I made my point there. If not, I'll have to come back to it. Jim says, and because of personality cult, which is what National Socialism became, is vulnerable to failure because, after all, Der Führer is never wrong. So Hitler's inner circle didn't dare question his tactical errors. And then he's specifically thinking about Dunkirk, etc., which I will address. But first, I will say that he says that there was a personality cult. But I've got that. I'm going to talk about that a little further down. So I'm just going to say here that when he says, had his general said, Mein Führer, are you sure this is wise? And had he listened, well, it's pretty well known, it should be for anybody who really studies Hitler, that his generals did say that a lot. And they always said that. And he didn't have an easy time with the generals, and they didn't just do what he said, and he didn't expect them to. He always used a lot of persuasion to try to convince them to see it his way. So this is an error in thinking that Hitler's inner circle was, even if it wasn't the generals, even if it was other politicians or whatever, that his inner circle didn't dare question him or point out that he might be in error. And he was quite open to that also. So this idea that everybody was just clicking their heels and rushing off to do what he said, and nobody wanted to think for themselves and didn't think for themselves because they're afraid, and Hitler would get all incensed and maybe, you know, say, off with your head and put them in prison or something because nobody could question him. It's totally false. I mean, it's absolutely bullshit. And we see in Table Talk, well, it's mostly him talking, but we see how he brings up subjects of people disagreeing with him quite a lot, you know, how he had to deal with it, and he had to try to get them to see it his way, because he didn't decide on something until he was convinced he was right about it. And here I will say that I am one of those people who thinks that Hitler was right. Hitler was right. I'll say Hitler was right, and I think Hitler was, for the most part, always right. At least at the time that he was saying things and doing things. You can always find later that things didn't go quite the right way. But as he was functioning at that time, from his own right attitude and the facts that he could know, he was right about things. Now, I'm going to get right on to Dunkirk here and then go back to the personality cult thing later. To say that Dunkirk and Barbarossa were a mistake is kind of ridiculous. And as an armchair general, 70 years later, you can say things like that and feel like you're in the know, but you might be lacking the true facts. Now, Dunkirk, that's one of the most popular things to hold against Hitler. That's that some people like to say, well, the war was lost right there. There was no point in going on after that, things like that. Well, in my view, and I think I'm right, is that Hitler's idea was that he had shown so much superiority by that point of German will and strength, the strength of his armies and his victories, that he was at that very, very strong position. And he thought that it was a good time to put out the hand to Britain for the partnership that he still, at that time, thought possible. He didn't want to beat Britain down to where they couldn't be friends again. He didn't want to, you know, shame Britain. He didn't want to make them desire only revenge against him and so on. He still at that point, and it was possible for him to still think that at that point. He didn't think so later. Shortly after this point, or at least after, by 1941, And by 1942, for certain, he didn't think that. He knew that wasn't possible, and he saw Britain differently. But at this point, he still had the idea of his goal for Europe as facing together the threat from the East, the Bolshevik threat, and the communist threat from Stalin. And he had the big picture in mind. And he thought this was a possibility to allow these British trapped British soldiers to get back to Britain. And he was holding out the hand of Britain joining with Germany. And we know the plan that he had, that Britain would keep its empire and would keep control of the seas with its great naval force, and Germany would control the European continent with its army and would go into Russia and would succeed there without Britain, without having to continue to fight Britain, and America wasn't in the war yet. So this was the big picture that he had, and I think it was smart and wise, and it was thinking outside the box. We could say, well, we've captured these Brits here, and we need to round them up, and then, you know, it's going to be a big blow against Britain. Well, it was already a blow against Britain, a victory in France. They took Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, and France. That was already, you know, that was an amazing achievement there. But they had to occupy all these places. And the other consideration, see, was that if they then invaded Britain, they would have to occupy it. Now, they could have just kept those men and not occupied it, but this also shows that Hitler was a man of grand gestures and a man of generosity. He's a very generous man, and he didn't want to fight against his fellow Europeans, as some people like to say. He didn't want to do that. He had to do it because they declared war on him and on his nation and on his Reich. So this, I think, was not the great turning point that people want to make it out to be. It showed the nature of Adolf Hitler, and it showed the nature of the British, that they couldn't take that, and they had no intention of being friends with National Socialist Germany at all. I'll go on to Barbarossa, and I'm just so happens there's a lot I could say about Barbarossa without this new Himmler speech that we have available now, but I thought, well, I'll just take this because it's pretty good, and I'll quote it. We know, it's known from all kinds of books and information, that Stalin was planning to attack Europe and had all these divisions and planes and so on the right on the border in an attack position, not in a defensive position. And Hitler had understood that was happening. He was planning to eventually take on the Soviet Union, but now he thought he had to do it quickly as possible, and that's why the Barbarossa invasion took place. And it was a very excellent timing, but in the end, they weren't able to overcome the huge power that Stalin had amassed in Russia and the vast manpower that he had to draw on and so on. So people now will say, well, that was his big mistake. That he should never have done that, and everything would have gone along the same way as they said before. Everything would have gone along just fine, and nobody would have bothered Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist regime there in Germany, and we could all be living well today. We could all be National Socialists today, and Europe would be free today, etc. As some of you might know, and I've put on my website, that the Shoah blogger on his blog has been translating this Himmler speech from August 1944, 2 months after the July 20th assassination attempt at Wolfschanze against Hitler, and in the inner map room during a meeting they were having. Really a horrible, shocking event, and the fact that it could even have taken place. And then to discover that it was arranged, it was traitors, the people behind it were in the German high command, right there. Oh, and so I'm going to quote here from this Himmler speech, just one little part of it. It makes everything very clear. He says, now comes 1941, the war against Russia. In these circles, there was a big hesitation. In circles, he means the military circles, and particularly the German Army High Command circles. They said, we don't need the war with Russia. Stalin would have never done anything to us. But alone the fact that Herr Stalin gathered 20,000 tanks at the border speaks for itself. What we found at the border speaks for itself. I recently told someone, you know, it is clear you're absolutely right that Stalin put his army together just to play a little war game. That's why he needed those 20,000 tanks and the huge air force. I'm going to have to point out here, in case you miss it, that Himmler is being ironic here, or you might even say sarcastic, when he says, you know, it's clear, you're right, Stalin just put that all there to play a war, for a war game. He says, Himmler goes on, we were lucky, even if we should not keep a square meter of Russia as it looks today. So he's admitting that they might not keep, this is August 1944. It looks like they're not going to keep any of what they gained in Russia. But he says, but we'll get back many thousands of kilometers, no doubt about it. Well, he's being positive, saying they're still going to get back a lot of what they've retreated, and they'll still get some of it back, which they didn't. But he says, but he's being positive. He says, but even if we should not keep a square meter, realizing this is possible, this decision of the Führer was the rescue of Germany and Europe in 1941. And he means that, and many people say that and believe that what Hitler did, what Barbarossa did and was, ended up saving Germany and Europe from being overtaken by the Soviet Union. So for that reason, it has its positive effect and was worthwhile. Had to be done, you might say. It had to be done. In the beginning of the Russian campaign in 1941, the lightning victories take place thanks to the bold revolutionary blitzkrieg strategy and tactics of the Führer, and the generals are duly enthusiastic. But already at that time, I am beginning to see problems and errors which I have been trying to remedy, especially in the training of my officer corps. He's talking about his SS officer corps. I am talking primarily of moral shortcomings of that once excellent officer corps, and so on. Well, this is the subject of his speech, is the moral failings of this officer corps. But that's the end of what I'm quoting there from Himmler about Barbarossa. And so I'll now go on to Hitler declaring war on the USA, as Jim says, because of the tripartite pact. I don't know if that was the reason. They think that that's a mistake. He thinks that was a mistake also, and that's also commonly there on a lot of places around on the internet. And this is really an easy one, because the United States was already in the war, even though they hadn't declared war. They were involving themselves, as it's well known. And Germany was ignoring the USA and what they were doing in order not to make it worse, you see, and in order not to give the United States a reason and an excuse for declaring war on Germany or behaving even more aggressively against Germany than they were. But now, with the war between Japan and the United States, Hitler decided, and I don't think he decided that against the advice of everybody else, that they could fight this out in the open. And once they were able to do that, the Germans did a lot of damage to the United States Navy, especially with their submarines. The Jewish Anglo-American League against German National Socialism could be spoken of and attacked openly also. And Hitler was doing that. In fact, he did that in the very speech that he declared war. Roosevelt was a devious opponent and tool of the Jews, so there was no way to play nice with him. And we know about the Potocki papers, which show that the United States was an enemy of Germany from 1939 on. I mean, their diplomacy was clearly anti-German, pro-British, and they were doing everything they could to work with the Poles to continue to provoke Poland to be antagonistic toward Germany. So the Roosevelt-Churchill pact was busy provoking Poland so that Poland wouldn't sign an agreement with Hitler, which is what Hitler wanted. You know, Hitler never wanted to destroy Poland. He liked Poland being there. He wanted understanding between Poland and Germany, and he liked Poland being there because it was a protective buffer between Russia and Germany. It was Poland that wouldn't be friends with Germany. It was Poland that was saying was constantly being unwilling to sign any agreements and being very recalcitrant when it came to Danzig and the corridor issue, which was only very reasonable from Germany. And if Germany and Poland had a friendly relationship, that would have been, there was no problem with that. But Poland was not interested in friendship with Germany. It became increasingly clear because they wanted to be friends with Britain and America too, and they were doing the bidding of Britain and America in completely giving the cold shoulder to Germany, even while the whole game was that they would pretend like they were going to be coming to an agreement. They would promise to have meetings, they would discuss things and say they might sign something, but in the end they didn't do it, and it was very, very frustrating to Hitler's government. In fact, it was insulting. And it got down to where they were just plain insulting Hitler. And also, the attacks on the Germans in Poland were increasing for that very reason, partly for that very reason. And Poland was just itching. In fact, they couldn't even stop from saying they were itching to go to war against Germany. So finally, there was nothing that Hitler could do but to attack Poland first and do it in his own way rather than wait this out and let the situation get worse and worse. This is what he did, and thinking that it could be a contained war and the British and French would stay out. But they declared war on Germany, but they didn't begin war. They just sat back and started building up their military preparedness. So in this case, well, I got into that Poland thing, but it was really about declaring war on the USA. So the USA was such an enemy. I guess that's the point there. The USA was such an enemy all this time, and the Germans knew it, that finally Hitler thought he might as well come out in the open, declare war so that he could attack the US. You can't attack countries that you haven't declared war on, according to international law. So that was the reason for that. Now, on the Volk, let's see. Oh, yeah, no, I'm getting ahead of myself here. So then Jim also said, after he lists these three things that I just replied to, is for this reason I consider myself a National Socialist as opposed to a Hitlerist, similar to how Marxists will say they're communists but not Stalinists. I think National Socialism should be about the Volk and not any one individual, and to put principle before personalities, as the 12-steppers say. Yeah, I'm familiar with that, principles before personalities. I have quite a bit to say on this, but I say to Jim that you are being idealistic without being realistic. You know, it's nice to say these things. Oh, yes, we should, you know, it should be about the people and not a single individual. Of course, you have to have a leader, don't you? You don't want to make Hitler the center of everything. That's what was wrong. But he's not being realistic. And, you know, to say that it's similar to say that you're... he says that he can say that he's a National Socialist, but not a Hitlerist. Just like you can say that you're a communist, but not a Stalinist. Well, the two things are not equal, because Stalin did not invent Marxism in any way, shape, or form. But Germany's National Socialism was created by Adolf Hitler. Now, people can say National Socialism was not invented by Adolf Hitler, but German National Socialism was the creation of Adolf Hitler, and the 25 points of the National Socialist Party and so on. And it's not really separate from him. You can talk about some generic National Socialism if you want, but did any generic National Socialism ever succeed anywhere? I mean, do we have examples of it? We have examples of people in in Italy and Spain and where else, maybe Romania, I don't know, writing about it. And we have examples of fascist leaders trying to establish themselves in places like England and Romania and others, Oswald Mosley and the Romanian leader Codronou and so on, but they never succeeded in winning over enough and taking over the government. Only Adolf Hitler did that, and they didn't have a national socialism like his either. They didn't have a whole program worked out. Maybe they had some kind of a program. But there's no other example of this kind of a system except the one that Adolf Hitler not only came up with, but, or let's say he didn't come up with it, but he brought it into reality and kept it going for many years and in great success before the war. So you can't separate it. You can try to. But when people talk about National Socialism and say, I'm a National Socialist, well, I don't agree with Hitler too much, and I don't like Germany too much, whatever, but I like National Socialism. It's about the people. Well, you know, that's not going to get you anywhere, and it's not just that. It's not just that. To be for the people, you're just a populist. You can just say you're a populist. If you want to say we need to have our government, we need to have things coming from the people, not from above, but from below, from the people. On this people, on the Volk, or the Folk, the fact is that Volk cannot do anything without a leader, that the leader is. That's where the focus is. Because as Hitler said not long ago in the table talk that we were reading, the Folk cannot do anything, and the Folk cannot make a decision. You can't expect them to. The leadership has to do that. The leadership has to make decisions. And in that Platterhoff speech that I published recently that Carlos Porter translated, and is at CarolynYeager.net, he talks about this, too, a lot. He's talking to the officers, in 1944, around this same time, it was in May, before that assassination attempt, and he's telling them about what is expected of them as leaders, that they are leaders and they have to make decisions. And he's saying that if you might not want to make a decision. You might be afraid to make a decision. He doesn't say it that way, but that's the way I'm putting it. You'd like somebody else to make it, somebody higher up than you, everybody thought that Adolf Hitler was making all the decisions. He wasn't, and he couldn't, and he didn't want to. It was a top-down hierarchy, right, but then as the power and the responsibility, it kept flowing downward, and at the officer level in the military, he said, you have to make decisions about life and death, and if you're afraid to make them, well, can't be afraid to make them, and you might not make them right. You're not going to be found at fault if your decisions don't all turn out right. That's just the way it goes. See, but you have to make a decision, because decisions have to be made. You know, so this is very profound, really, but I'm not going to say any more about it than that. So, and everybody in the National Socialist Party in Germany agreed on this and understood it. And this is what kept discipline going. Discipline was very important. The leadership had to keep the discipline, and then to just keep the people disciplined. And he said, as I already said, he said often enough that the people cannot do anything of themselves, nor can they make a decision. That has to be done by the leadership. And the leadership has to be under the discipline of the leader. That's the Führerprinzip, that there is... There is someone, the leader. Of course, leader in German, everybody knows that Führer is the German word for leader. When they said mein Führer, they're saying my leader, because that was the whole idea that it was based on, and it's a good idea if you have the right people. But you have to have somebody very special, like Der Führer was. He was special, and we can see now, from this perspective, nobody has come along like him, and nobody has ever done what he has done. I keep saying that, you know, that all these people who say, well, he didn't do so great, well, we need to do this thing, you know, we need to cooperate, we need to do blah, blah, we need to, well, do it then. But they can't do it. They can't do it, and it's never been done. So even the Germans don't have anybody to do it now. You have to appreciate what you've got when you've got it, and if you don't, you lose it, well, then you're gone. Now, I say that if Jim is a National Socialist, he must accept the principle of leadership. He says he's a National Socialist and he likes National Socialism, but he doesn't want a personality cult. He doesn't want this leader who everybody has to listen to and so on. He doesn't want a Führer. He seems to be saying that. Or the Führer must be more willing to listen to everybody, so he wants a more democratic system. He wants the Führer to be to not have the right to make the final decision, which is what Hitler had, in spite of the fact that people could argue with him and disagree with him and so on. He had the final decision, and that was the way it was supposed to be. Somebody has to. When it comes to that, he wanted decisions made on all different levels. But if there were things that got too important or people were not able to come to a decision, and finally the final decision was his. And this seems to bother Jim, who thinks that he was forcing his own decision on everything. But if Jim says he's a National Socialist, and this is what I want to say to all those people who claim to be National Socialists, that you have to accept the principle of the leadership principle. It's not leadership by the folk. It's not. It has to be leadership by the leader. And that's essential to National Socialism. So let's look at the personality cult issue. Jim said, and because the personality cult, which is what National Socialism became, is vulnerable to failure, because after all, Der Führer is never wrong, so Hitler's inner circle didn't dare question his tactical errors. Well, wrong. You see, there was no cult of personality around Hitler. There was no cult of personality in the Third Reich, German National Socialism, the Third Reich National Socialism. There was the leadership principle, which I've already explained. And, you know, think about it. Were there ever any large images of Hitler in the cities of Germany on big banners or hanging from lampposts or whatever, or billboards or whatever, like you see, like existed in the Soviet Union or exist in a lot of places where they put images of the government puts images of its own people up there like that? Mostly communist. That's mostly a communist type of. You didn't see that in Germany. All you ever saw on all these banners and flags that were hanging around when something big was going on was the swastika. The swastika, the symbol of the National Socialist Party that Hitler had picked out. So that represented National Socialism, that represented the folk. There was no pictures of him. He didn't like that. He didn't want that. He didn't allow it. And one thing I'll say is kind of interesting is that we were reading about the art exhibits in Munich. Now, Hitler instituted an annual art exhibit in the great Munich Art Museum for German art. And all German artists were allowed to enter their artwork into this exhibit. There it was selected. So only the best ones, they are a group of judges, how big art shows are, and only the best ones were selected. So there were over 1,000 works of art in that exhibit every year. But they were selected out of like 7,000 or 8,000 that were entered. And naturally in Germany, a lot of artists, they loved Hitler, you know. He was their leader, and he had done a lot for them already. They knew how much he had accomplished, and they were all for him. So a lot of these artists would paint pictures or do sculptures of him. And so there were a whole lot of them entered, and some of them were of the better artwork. But Hitler, there were so many images of him selected, and that bothered him, and he made a rule right off the bat, only one. maybe two, but I seem to remember it was only one. The best one of all, of a picture of himself, could be in that art show, but no more than that. He didn't want people to go in there and see all these paintings of him, and even though the people wanted to do them, and they continued to do them, and they would send him what they had done, which were pictures of him and so on, all kinds of Germans. This was just a German thing. Another thing that's rather touching, but it's common too, was that most of the homes in Germany had a picture of Adolf Hitler on their wall. Well, he was the leader of the country, and that they had been doing that for hundreds of years, and it's done in other countries too. Do you think in other countries of Europe they didn't have pictures of their current king or maybe queen on their wall? They all did. They all do that. And Hitler became, well, maybe probably before he became chancellor, but certainly by that time, it was very common to have a picture of him. But it wasn't something that he did or insisted on or cared about, but he didn't forbid it. That would have been terrible if he did that, because they wanted it there. Now, another thing is that Adolf Hitler was not planning or even wanting to rule until death, like so many autocratic leaders do and want. But he was always thinking about his successors and even trying to find one. And he was even trying to get Hans Rudel to stop flying in 1944 and come stay at headquarters and with him to learn the job. And even in the beginning of 45, he was trying to do that. But Rudel was such a devoted pilot and so devoted to his crews and so on that he didn't want to leave. In fact, he hardly ever wanted to get out of his plane. He wanted to just keep going and bombing things, you know, and helping the troops, doing support for the troops and helping them to win, because he was a 100% fighter, even though he realized that Hitler was trying to approach him about... he absolutely told him to stop flying, and he even once ordered him to do it. But Rudel then had his kills, as they call them, you know, the successes that he had in flying, put on somebody under somebody else's name in his squadron instead of his name, so it wouldn't be known that he was still flying. But he did keep flying. He didn't follow the Führer's order, and I think, I don't know if it was the Führer's order, but after the Führer asked him to, and he said, oh, you wouldn't ask that of me, would you? It might have been Goering or the Reichsmarschall who gave that order. The Luftwaffe gave the order to him, but he didn't obey that. And a lot of things like that could happen because he was held in such high esteem, and Hitler understood. And Hitler also knew, and he said this, that he couldn't order a person to come and learn to be the Führer of Germany. If you didn't want to do it, you couldn't order somebody to do it. And anybody in a high position, he felt he could never order them, and he didn't order, except that as commander-in-chief, he would finally give out the order that way. But he was not he insisted on things being done as he thought they should be once he came to that conclusion. But it wasn't because people had, you know, that people couldn't disagree with him, and they did. And he spent a lot of time explaining to his officers and generals why he thought he was right in what he wanted them to do, and why he thought they were wrong. And mostly, and they always went along with it because they couldn't come up with an argument that was better than his argument, or they just realized that they couldn't outrank him either. So, and that was his job, to be the final decider of things. Hitler was doing his job because he thought he was the best qualified. He had started out from 1920 or 1919 because he had this idea of what Germany needed and how to save Germany, that it needed to be saved. And he continued on because no one else was doing what he was doing. And he continued and devoted his life and his health and his whole being to being the Führer of Germany because He knew that he was the only one capable of accomplishing what he had accomplished and what he hoped to accomplish. Not because he wanted to be the great person, the great dictator, either of Germany, certainly not of the world, or of Europe, or of the world, but because he was convinced that no one else could do it. No one else ever had, no one was trying to, only him. So he didn't agree with the idea of more democracy or more, let's do more group planning, you know, and see if we can come to an agreement here, which they never could come to an agreement with things like that. Generally, somebody has to give way, but it's all very inefficient to do things that way. So Hitler was not this dictator that he's described as being, and I'm surprised that someone who wants to be a National Socialist should think that way. Or somebody who is a National Socialist or calls himself a National Socialist should think that Hitler had a personality like that. And that Germany turned into a cult of personality around Hitler. I'm sure, I know that a better argument against all this and a better defense can be made, but this is the best one I've done tonight because I don't want to go into it too long and I am not really up to doing any more than this, but I think this basically touches on everything that he brought up in his email. I will say that I would like this conversation to continue, and I can bring it up and on other shows, and I can have guests. Now I've got my Skype recorder downloaded, and so I can now record programs between me and other people on Skype, and then upload it to my Blog Talk program page, and do it that way. So I'm not as limited as I had been as I'm learning this other technology, which is not too hard to do. So I'm going to close on that, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. This has been Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on March 16th, 2015. Good night.